This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Tech Talk. My name is Jeff Sandhu. The Stop, Think, Connect is a national public awareness campaign in the US that's aimed at increasing the understanding of cyber threats and empowering the American public to be safer and more secure online. And also, the month of October was the National Cybersecurity Awareness Month in the US. But you know what? Cybersecurity is a shared responsibility, and we all have to do a part to keep the internet safe. Yes, you've heard it all, but time and time again, we keep hearing about breaches, hacks, stolen identities, ransomware, and the list goes on. Not only we sometimes make it easier for these things to happen, but cybercriminals, they are getting smarter too. So, how do you protect yourself online? Well, here with me today is an expert in cybercrime issues.
Hi, my name's Tom Docherty. I'm the regional legal advisor for cybercrime stationed here at the U.S. Embassy in Kuala Lumpur.
And that itself is fascinating, because why would a position like this exist? And your hub is here in Malaysia. You're looking at cybercrime activities in Asia, in a few countries in Southeast Asia at least. So tell me a bit of a background, and how did you actually end up here at the U.S. Embassy in KL?
Sure. Well, I'm what we call a federal prosecutor in the United States. I work for the U.S. Justice Department, and I'm assigned from a section called the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section in Washington, D.C., which is a group of 40 specialized prosecutors focused on cybercrime. Mm-hmm. And I've been there since 2007. Before that, I worked in a the U.S. Attorney's Office in Las Vegas, Nevada. Mm. And the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section, we do a lot of international outreach. And we found over the last few years, both the Justice Department and the State Department found that it would be helpful to have somebody physically located out in the field to be involved with these sorts of outreach, computer crime, digital evidence outreach activities, instead of sending somebody from the United States for a week or 2 weeks at a time. Because very often, the most effective way, or the way we can be most effective in most things, is through personal relationships, by having somebody there that you can call, that you can deal with very easily. Mm. And so after looking at it, the Justice Department and the State Department decided that they would create this new position of regional legal advisor for cybercrime for Southeast Asia. And when they started to look at where the best place would be to put it in Southeast Asia, there was just several factors that pointed to Kuala Lumpur. And so in 2015, the position was created, and I came here in September to start.
Right. So 2015 is when the whole position was created, and you are the first of any of its kind in position anywhere else in the world. Am I right?
Well, I'm the first in the history of the U.S. government,
right.
Yes,
okay.
And currently the only one. Yes.
Right. So the position is very interesting then, since you're the first one. You're also, I think, it's probably more of like a test bed for hopefully, more of these kind of positions around the world itself. Why cybercrime specifically?
Well, because cybercrime is international just by its very nature. No matter whether we're in the United States or here in Malaysia, when you go online, it's very unlikely that you are never going to touch, or you're not touching some other country when you're going online. Mm. So, just even now with, say, whether it's Microsoft or Google, most of the service providers in the United States, they are offshoring most of their data storage, in Luxembourg, in Ireland. So just by that very nature, we have to look from a cybercrime perspective in the United States. We need to look at it from an international perspective, because for us to be able to be effective, for us to be able to identify, to be able to properly investigate, to properly prosecute people, we need to be prepared to be able to obtain evidence, to be able to secure evidence, to be able to work with foreign counterparts, because this evidence is cross-border. It is outside of the United States. And for us to be able to be effective, we need to recognize that. And that's really the genesis of my position. Like I say, a vast majority of large-scale cybercrime cases in the United States have an international component, where we will have to seek the preservation, say, of digital evidence in a place like Malaysia or Singapore or Luxembourg or Ireland. And then we have to go through the process of working with that foreign government to have them provide the evidence to us. And that is a long, difficult, complicated process. And whatever efforts we can make to make it a simpler, faster, more efficient process, we're going to try to do that. And again, that's sort of the genesis or one of the reasons for creating this position.
Is this also like an answer to, you know, getting, you know, cyber criminals to justice, because it just seems so hard to get these people behind bars?
Certainly. Exactly. And it's a necessary or it's a needs to be a shared effort. It needs to be a situation where we are all basically on the same page, that countries of the world are all trying to get to the same end. Because, and in fact, one of the things that I'm working on very closely or that I've put a lot of effort into here in Malaysia is something encouraging your government, the Malaysian government, to join something called the Budapest Convention on Cybercrime, which is currently the only international treaty focused exclusively on cybercrime. And one of the elements of that treaty is that it creates a method for the member countries to share digital evidence more easily and more quickly. So the whole purpose is that if I'm investigating a case in the United States and I see that there's some connection to Malaysia, it gives me another avenue, another mechanism, a more effective avenue to try to ask, say, the Malaysian government to preserve the digital evidence and then to provide it so it could be used in a criminal prosecution in the United States.
Has it been difficult because, you know, we are working, you are obviously working with very sensitive data that, you know, when you talk about sharing information, you know, whether it's a cyber criminal activity or just a normal activity, data itself is very critical in that sense of sharing it with another department, for example. Has that been a difficult process then to get the understanding of, like, you know, there's a reason to this and there's a benefit to this as well, which is, you know, getting the internet to be a safer place, which seems to be, you know, our usual go-to place for anything nowadays?
Right. Well, in terms of say, privacy and sharing of data, at least in the United States, when we go to a service provider and we request them to provide information related to a criminal prosecution, that information is safeguarded by the mere fact that it's being requested under our criminal procedure and our criminal laws. In other words, we can't disclose it publicly unless under very limited circumstances. And typically, say, when and if we would go to trial, and I've dealt with this, you know, I've prosecuted many internet fraud and credit card cases, when we would actually submit the records into evidence, we would have a clean copy that would be put what's called under seal, which would be protected, that only the parties that are that are required to be able to see it can access it. But the copy that would go to the public would be redacted to protect the identities, protect the credit card numbers, or protect the what we call social security numbers of the victim. So we've not found that being much of an issue in terms of getting other countries to share data under the rubric of a criminal prosecution, because they know that we have requirements, there are legal requirements under U.S. law to protect that information.
But in terms of transparency of certain governments and agencies within, you know, the region itself, we all are at various different stages of, you know, understanding, you know, of transparency of certain data. Has that been difficult as well? Because you're looking at, you know, not just Malaysia, you're also looking at, you know, Thailand, Vietnam, and these are obviously different countries and the different levels of understanding as well. How has that process been in?
Well, again, that's part of the reason why I'm here, is to try to create a common understanding among all of us as to what information is necessary, or what information is appropriate, or what information or how countries should interact with service providers within their individual countries to ensure that there is an effective mechanism to be able to protect your citizens. Because if and I know it is controversial, and we struggle with it in the United States as well, that it's a balance. It's a balance between privacy of the individual and protection of society. And there's a tension, no matter what country you go to, in finding the right balance. But there needs to be a balance to be effective, because if you skew too far to one side, the other side's going to be negatively affected.
Thomas Dorothy, the U.S. Department of Justice Regional Legal Advisor for Cybercrime in Asia, is with me on the show. More after this, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
And we're back. My name is Jeff Zandu, and my guest is Thomas Dorothy. He's the U.S. Department of Justice Regional Legal Advisor for Cybercrime in Asia. Thomas, just as we were learning about your role earlier on, you're also now based here in KL, which is interesting to have a position that's never been created in U.S. history before and make KL as the hub. Why so?
Well, like I said earlier, the reasons were all positive in the sense that that so much wasn't an issue in terms of we haven't seen it's not so much that there's a reluctance or sort of the level of transparency between countries has the impact or has is the determining factor in terms of our ability as say the criminal enforcement arm of the U.S. government to be able to work with the criminal enforcement arm of other countries. For us here in Kuala Lumpur, the reason why the position was placed here was more, like I said, about that we have a good working relationship with your government. Frankly, the embassy, it's also a logistical reason. The U.S. Embassy here in Kuala Lumpur agreed to host this new position. And also that it was a just logistically sort of centrally located within Southeast Asia. So I would say that the decision was more not only it was logistical, but also it was a friendly environment for us to be able to work in. And that has borne itself out. I mean, I've been able to have a very, very positive working relationship with not only the various aspects of the Malaysian government, but also NGOs and private sector. It is, frankly, from my perspective, it really has been a very good decision to place this position in Kuala Lumpur.
And so what kind of criminal activities that you've witnessed, not just here in Malaysia, but you know, since you've taken on this role, what kind of activities you've seen in this region that you know needs to be addressed?
Well, I'll say from you know, particularly in Malaysia, I have seen that the love scam, we call it catfishing. Mm. I mean, it is a problem here in Malaysia. But general internet fraud, whether it's ransomware or credit card fraud or also what we call business email compromise, where, say, hackers will get into a company's email system here and then be able to use that domain to pretend as if they're a company in Malaysia and send emails to other companies around the world to get them to send large amounts of money supposedly related to a contract and divert it to a new, say, SWIFT code or a different bank account. So you see all of, you know, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia.
It's a global problem.
It's a global problem. and that's the thing. It's not like there's one particular type of fraud or one particular type of, quote, cybercrime here versus another that you wouldn't see.
There's definitely hotspots. When you look at the world map itself, you know, there's clearly hotspots of where these activities are being carried out. And if so, why are these hotspots when, you know, the internet's supposed to be a place where, you know, geographically doesn't really matter?
Right. Well, it's all about part of why, thankfully, you and I appreciate, you know, you bringing me on today. It's about, you know, certain places making themselves harder targets than others. There are certain systems or networks or areas where it's easier for hackers to get into, or it's easier for hackers to make more money in a particular place versus another. But, you know, again, it's a situation where it calls for a need for there to be a common or a rising of the basic security among all countries in all areas, because that's the thing. No matter where you put the pressure point, you're generally just going to push the cyber criminals to those areas that are weaker. So that's why it's so important. And Frank, again, part of the reason why I'm here is to try to help create that layer, that strong layer across the board, as opposed to keeping weak spot, weak points, which will attract cyber criminals. Mm.
But it also comes down to how businesses are being run or managed in this part of the region itself.
Sure.
And there's sure a clear difference in terms of, if you look at China, for example, it's a very different way, even though it's part of Asia. And now here in Malaysia, Vietnam, in Thailand, all three of these different countries have a very different way and different laws pertaining to how, an operation should be run.
Right.
With that, though, do you then come in here with an understanding of, these are certain types of frameworks or laws that have been in place that have seen an improvement in how businesses could be run a lot more safer and thus making your job a lot easier? Do you then come in and share that kind of knowledge that we then gain that kind of benefit as well?
All the time. I mean, I not only work with law enforcement in all of the countries that you mentioned, but also I do a lot of outreach to the private sector. In fact, I just spoke earlier this month. The Malaysian Manufacturers Association had me come speak on a panel about cybersecurity, and I've spoken to many other groups about the same thing. And a lot of it is common sense. A lot of it is getting companies to realize that this is something that is worth their time and their money and their resources to put on the front end, as opposed to wait until they're a victim of an attack to then try to remediate or mitigate the issue on the back end. So yes, I mean, and that's also a part of, even though I'm focused more exclusively on cyber crime as opposed to cybersecurity, it's certainly important, especially say with ransomware. For us, we have found it can be very difficult to find the individuals who are specifically responsible for, say, sending the ransomware attack and pulling the money back. So what have we done in the United States? We've focused in two ways. One, we have focused on preventive measures and educating companies and educating consumers about how they can protect themselves from ransomware, but then also going against the architects of the botnets and the designers of the software, the people who are actually putting it out there on the web and trying to take down the large networks that is distributing the ransomware, as opposed to trying to go after each one-off where somebody is, say, BFM becomes a victim of ransomware and trying to go after that one person. Mm. Because typically you'll have one individual who is responsible for multiple thousands potentially potential ransomware attacks. Mm. Because it's a matter of again, it's like casting a wide net. You're not expecting to be successful in every case, but all you need is one or two or three or 10, and you're going to be able to make a significant amount of money or enough money to make it worth your while.
Well, what's your definition of a cyber crime? Because it encompasses so many things. And here in this part of the region, I think one of the areas, money laundering is also something that we now use the web to carry out these kind of illegal activities as well. So, what's the definition of cyber crime here for you?
That's a great question. Thank you very much for asking, because that's one of the very first things that when I talk with any group, that's one of the very first things that I talk about. Cybercrime, from our perspective, from a U.S. law enforcement perspective, we recommend or champion that it should be looked at very broadly. That cybercrime is not only the sort of traditional hacking crime where you have somebody who's trying to break into a particular network and steal information. Mm. Cybercrime also is any crime that is internet or computer enabled. So really now, today, in this day and age, I'm sure you have a cell phone in your pocket.
Can't run away from it.
Right. I mean, what are cell phones? What are mobile phones? They're basically, they're mobile computers. And any crime, potentially, there is digital evidence related to that crime. So potentially every crime is a cyber crime. And not only do we argue that you should consider any crime that has any internet or computer enabled aspect to it, but also just the concept of digital evidence and being able to identify, preserve, and share digital evidence should be looked at under the cybercrime rubric. Because, again, we've gotten to a point where, from our perspective in the United States, pretty much every crime has some cybercrime component or has some cyber component. And, in fact, I think, I've been a prosecutor in the United States since 2001. First 10 years, occasionally, it was sort of a rare thing to actually have digital evidence involved. Now, judges and juries in the United States expect it. If you don't have, even if it's a bank robbery, if it's an assault case, if you don't have, say, the cell phone information showing, say, the GPS locator or tracker information showing that a person was in a particular place, a particular time, juries want to know why, or the judges want to want to know why. And that's one of the things that I've been working not only with Malaysia but other countries in the region, encouraging them and trying to make it easier for them to use digital evidence in every prosecution.
Mm. So what needs to change here? We're approaching the new year now. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are, you know, whether it's the private sector or it's the government sector or the agencies involved, I'm sure they're looking at ways of, you know, to stay better protected online or, you know, just have better frameworks in place. What can be done?
Well, I'll tell you this too. I mean, if you use a credit card online, if you've ever used a credit card online, there's a pretty good chance that credit card number is sitting in some database somewhere on the dark web. And you just, frankly, it's a matter of luck whether you're going to be a victim or not. Yeah. But what can you do? Well, first off, a big problem, it's not talked about very often, but a big problem is counterfeit software. Mm. If you're not using legitimate software on your laptop, you open yourself up to become a victim, a much greater chance that you're going to be a victim. So using legitimate software. And then part and parcel of that is then using the different types of security software and keeping that updated with your legitimate operating system. Because say if you're running a counterfeit Microsoft operating system, you can't call Microsoft and ask for the patch, or you're not going to get the automatic patches. And frankly, cyber criminals know that, and they exploit that. And that's one of the big problems that we have when you see these huge, whether it's WannaCry or other sorts of ransomware or other types of malware being distributed, you know, huge amounts of infections. It's because many of the computers are running counterfeit software on their computers. So that's one thing that you can do. Secondly, be very, very careful about what you're downloading or what you're clicking on. Phishing through spam, in other words, you get an email promising something that's too good to be true, and you know, you click on this particular download to be able to get a free, you know, car or a vacation or some sort of offer. That's also the delivery device of how hackers and how cyber criminals are getting malware onto your computer to then make you a victim. So being very careful about what you're looking at on your email and what you're clicking on and what attachments you're downloading. Also, it's just, again, and you know, we can talk about this, and I know that people hear about it all the time, but they don't follow it. But to be very careful about that can also protect you very easily or you know, make you a harder target.
There's also a lot of talk about, you know, the government sector in trying to be more smart. They're looking at, you know, Singapore's looking at a smart nation. Here in Malaysia, we're looking at, you know, in doing small areas of smart city where it becomes a gold mine for a lot of these hackers who now seem to have more opportunities to get into a system and, you know, do crime. How do you go about being in a position of an advisor to, you know, criminal activities that happen on the web? It's not going to go off anytime soon. It's not like 2018, you know, we're going to see the numbers falling down. That would be great. But, you know, it's going to go up just simply because the number of doors are being opened up. What are you personally, you know, looking forward to in 2018 that you're keen to work on and get it done in that sense? Like, you know, that one goal that you would like to see?
Well, I can tell you, you know, personally, my one goal is to try to secure as many countries here in Southeast Asia to join the Budapest Convention on Cybercrime. So I'm hoping that I can see Malaysia, that they'll be announcing sometime in 2018 that they've decided to join. There are only 55 countries that are members.
What entails in that agreement?
It's just a matter of the government. The agreement, basically, there are three components to the agreement. One, like I said, it's an additional method for countries to be able to share information, what's called a mutual legal assistance treaty. The second is there's a mechanism, an expedited mechanism for the member countries to be able to preserve digital information because, you know, it's so fungible that digital information can be destroyed so quickly. It provides an additional sort of agreement between these countries to, when they get a request, to preserve, freeze in place any digital evidence related to a case. And then third, it requires a certain standard for cybercrime law so that all of the member states have a certain standard, a bare minimum of what they criminalize, what they call, what they define as a cybercrime under the law, and also how they go about interacting with service providers to be able to require them to preserve and to share information. And to give you an example, I'm sure you're familiar with the Sony hack. The United States government was able to investigate and identify and to preserve evidence in that case much faster than we otherwise would have been able to, because we were able to go to fellow countries in the Budapest Convention and ask for their assistance and be able to preserve and obtain information very quickly that made our job a lot easier. And that's sort of what I'm sort of proselytizing and recommending to the countries here in Southeast Asia.
So why would one say no to something like this? What would be the reason that deter them, you know, from something like this?
I think part of it is that they want to ensure that they are ready from a legal standpoint, that their laws are in place. And it's also there are a lot of different things on a particular government's agenda. And it's a matter of this taking precedence or getting it pushed to the front. So I would say that it's a matter of ensuring that all the various elements, necessary elements within a government, see that it's important enough to expend the political will, because it's a treaty. I mean, it does take political will for a country to decide to do it.
But, you know, cybersecurity or just the internet itself, it's a global shared responsibility. It's not just any particular government or individual in that sense. It's a shared responsibility. And we all have to have that same mind of, you know, protecting the web, which is practically, it's part of our lives now. We can't run away from it. We can't say, I'm not going to go online anymore.
and I agree. But to be fair, I mean, there are some countries who take the position that they would rather see a broader, say, UN-sponsored information security or cyber security-specific treaty where cybercrime is only a part of it, whereas at least U.S. policy is that, at least at this point, the Budapest Convention is, frankly, the best and the only thing we have currently in force.
And then you've got, you know, certain countries like China, for example, who have their own way of, you know, protecting their own data and going through the process. And, you know, that's why they have this, you know, the great firewall of China in that sense. And it's tough. But hopefully we will see some conclusion, at least in 2018. We'll see a few more countries onto that list then.
I would hope so.
Cool. I've been speaking to Thomas Doherty. He's the regional legal advisor for cybercrime at the U.S. Department of Justice here in the embassy of Kuala Lumpur. This has been Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.